Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Good morning. This is Tracy Hales Vass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico. Today I'm talking with Stephen Steele about the first of his trilogy, The Canistar Factor. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Tracy.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm hoping you're working hard on the next installment of the Trouble with Miracles series.
It is finished. It is at the publisher, and at the moment it's being edited for punctuation and, picking the lint off the carpet, and the artwork is being done. It's called, the second one is called The Organ Grinder Factor, and it will be released late summer, early fall.
Oh, that's great. Because I really enjoyed the Canistar Factor, and I guess what we should do right now is share a little bit of a synopsis to let our listeners know what we're talking about.
Alrighty. It's, as you said, it's the first book in a three-book series called The Trouble with Miracles. It's called The Canistar Factor. And it's about an inexpensive, organically grown plant called Canistar that cures viral disease, everything from coronavirus and cancer to herpes and the common cold. And it's about the government and how the government and the media conspire with the medical industry to keep a miracle drug off the market.
It looks like you first wrote this quite a few years ago, pre-pandemic.
I wrote it. Yeah, this was the first novel that I wrote 10 years ago that basically had the good story to it, but it had beginner mistakes in it.
I understand that, yeah.
So you know, it's just the case of all artists as they evolve. So, say, you know, better than two-thirds of the people were really supportive, you know, 4- and 5-star reviews, and other people pointed out the fact that, you know, you got an author making making his own remarks, making political remarks, you know, preaching and one thing and another. And all these are beginner mistakes, and it's something a professional author just doesn't do. So when I got the opportunity, and I went on and wrote other things, but when I got the opportunity with this new publisher who was Speaking Volumes, you know, they published series. So I got the chance to go back and rewrite it, revise it, expand it, update it, and just, you know, do all the things that should have been done to take all of the obstacles out of it, you know, all of the objectionable things out of it, and just make it a good story.
It is a good story. And I especially like the way it reverberates with so many things we've heard in the past year, especially concerning the coronavirus vaccine, et cetera.
Exactly. Most people don't know this, but the FDA salaries are paid by the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, the people approving the drugs, I mean, are paid by the companies they're regulating. And drug companies, in general, I mean, they're not all evil, you know. And, I mean,
right.
Goodness knows, if we have a major surgery, we're grateful for painkillers for a couple of weeks. It doesn't mean we make a lifetime career out of them. But basically, drug companies only submit positive studies that support the effectiveness of the drug they're getting approved. Clinical data is often contrived, and side effects are frequently, you know, misminimized and misreported, and defective drugs are often approved for sale. So
the pharmaceutical company is so driven by politics.
It is. You know, this is the only country in the world, in the industrialized world, that doesn't have some control over drug prices. And the drug companies can charge whatever they want, and basically, in this country, we pay twice as much as any place else. Now, there's no question that the pharmaceutical companies own and run and operate under the protection and their political influence, which is massive.
And I think that in Canastar, it illustrates that really well. Now, Canastar itself is, like you said, a natural organic cure-all, basically. But the pharmaceutical company is trying to do everything to squelch it.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that looking at the big picture, of course, you know, I mean, heck, something that eliminates most, you know, major health issues would be ultimately profitable. But, and this is a fact of life, you know, entrenched power wants to maintain status quo. So what they do is the Canastar is going to make a large number of their drugs, their really profitable, overpriced drugs, obsolete.
Right.
So they will virtually do anything to keep it off the market.
Well, your protagonists here, Sid and Alex, as the main protagonists, right, are really working together and end up being fugitives.
Right. They are fugitives because this plant and it has been criminalized. I mean, the plant it's been declared a Schedule I drug, you know,
right,
as horrible and addictive as heroin. And anyone who perpetrates it is, you know, is Pablo Escobar, you know.
Right.
But basically, you know, it's a harrowing adventure. You know, they're pursued, you know, there's kidnappings, manhunts, and political and corporate intrigue, and Wall Street corruption, drug addiction, suicides, arrests. There's a terrifying escapes. You know, it ranges from the Montana wilderness, you know, the high-tech world of Houston, Texas, political cesspool of Washington, D.C., you know. We get the whole sequence where there's the teeming jungles of Mexico, and of course, ultimately we end up on the 26,000 square mile Navajo Nation in the Four Corners, you know, and where we can safely grow the plant. But our protagonist, and ultimately, you know, all this is really background, because what we have to be emotionally involved and connected with the characters. I mean,
right,
we have to really care about the people, and then all this makes sense. So hopefully, I've achieved that, and you know, we care about Sid and Alex, and in the end, you know, they have to flee the country,
right,
and that's of course where the second book starts.
I know. I looked ahead a little bit, and so I'm excited to see that. And speaking of characters, there's great characters all along the way. I mean, with Otis and Eloise, and then Annie, and then the Abe. I really like him.
Yeah, he's a good old boy.
And it's interesting how you kind of flip the tables on us as far as the good guys can often look like bad guys.
Yeah, and bad guys can, and you know, I mean, that's what makes good writing and good storytelling is they're not, you know, the bad guys are not two dimensional.
Right.
I mean, who doesn't love Clint Eastwood movies, right?
Right.
You know, Every Which Way We'll Lose, you know, there's a motorcycle getting in. They are so evil and bad and awful. They're just terrible, you know.
Right.
You know, it's cartoonish. All of us, you know, you can name, I mean, what's the most awful person you can think of that ever, you know, Adolf Hitler, you know?
Right.
He tender moments with Eva Braun, you know?
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, they had to commit suicide. I mean, it's horrible, you know? But if you dramatize that and you really care. I mean, there's a great series on TV that's over now. It ran for 5 seasons called The Wire, and there was a black drug guy who robbed other drug dealers, you know. It was just awful, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he liked sugar-flavored Cheerios.
Right.
I mean, isn't that wonderful?
Right. I thought about The Wire when I was reading the book.
Really?
Yeah, because of
the
bad guys and their good parts.
Yeah. I mean, that was really, that was so well done because they got so involved in the, I mean, you cared about everybody, and you know the Stringer Bell and Avon Barksdale, you know, I mean, the worst guys in the world, but you really cared about them. You didn't want to see Stringer die.
Right.
Spoiler alert there.
Right. That's okay. We're not going to give a spoiler alert in the book, though, and that's what's important.
No, okay. In all my books, you know, I want to tell, and by the way, I'm right in the middle of writing the third one.
Okay, good.
Which is called The Fusion Factor.
The Fusion Factor, okay.
And fusion, I mean, what a wonderful miracle, right? I mean, a pollution-free world.
Right.
Except that in the wrong hands, it can turn the planet into space dust in a heartbeat.
Right.
So you've got a real problem of you know, if you do get your hands on it, what do you do with it? So the second book takes place in Africa and Israel. And all my books, I try to make a story nobody ever heard of. And then I try to tell you a good story with interesting characters. But the second one, they're all grounded in real world events and real mm-hmm. facts. The second one, when Sidney Alec's shipwreck off the west coast of Africa, off what's called the Slave Coast still today,
mm-hmm.
they end up in a country called Biana Bissau, or Bissau, however they pronounce it, and this is like one of the most poverty-stricken countries in the world. It is today run by Colombian drug lords.
Ooh.
Who use it as a transit point for shipping all their drugs. I mean, tons of drugs a week that come from Colombia, Guinea-Bissau, through there to Europe, you know?
Yeah.
So they end up there, and they have to flee for their lives, and they end up in Senegal, which is the country just north of there,
mm-hmm.
and Dakar. And they're immediately embroiled in what exists today as the child slavery problem.
Wow.
I mean, child slavery in Senegal is just rampant, worse than it was 400 years ago. And Dakar, of course, that's where Gori Island is, you know, the door of no return that's so infamous for slave trading. But anyway, so, I mean, they have to deal with that, and then the corrupt African government, and then in Israel they get involved in the Israeli-Palestinian horrors, which are going on at this very moment, and all this in wrapped around the fact that we have the organ grinder, which is a, you know, like the canister. It is, of course, fiction, but it's not that much of a stretch. You know how a 3D printer works, right?
Right.
All right. So the organ grinder effect, and the 3D printer uses four basic colors, and mm-hmm. it makes all other colors, right? So the organ grinder factor, I don't mean to get off track here, but I'm really excited about this book.
Good.
The organ grinder, the human body is made up of a couple of dozen basic chemicals, mm-hmm. you know, proteins and amino acids and all that kind of stuff. That's what is made up of, all these elements, just like the four colors and the... So the organ grinder factor can take these from these vats of the basic building blocks of the human body,
mm-hmm.
and it can go through and it can replace damaged and diseased human organs without having to remove the old ones first.
Wow. That's an interesting concept to play with.
I know. It really was. And what I really got stuck is I got all along, it's all exciting, and now we're about to do it. And now I got to describe how it works. I mean, really, how it works.
Right.
But as a writer, what I find, and I mean, you know, everybody has one thing that they do well, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a great professional golfer is a lousy skier,
and
a great cyclist can't play the piano. But I mean, my one thing is my one thing is I write. So whenever I go. Whenever I have a writing problem, which is usually at the end of the day, I go to bed and I wake up with the solution in
mm-hmm.
the morning, every day. It's just there. And so that's how I intuited the organ grinder, how it works.
Oh, that's great.
But you got to read the book to find it.
I know, and I'm looking forward to that. Yeah,
good.
Because then...
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, are we going to see Otis and Eloise again?
Otis does play a minor supporting role, and we do see him briefly at the end in the second book.
Okay, good to know.
Because Otis is Not to give spoilers, but Otis is running the Canistar Grow on the Navajo Nation.
Right.
You know, so I mean, he's sort of basically in charge of this whole thing now.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Once they get to that point.
Right.
And as people, such a great character because, you know, he was the local mortician.
Right. I love that. And he's a big guy.
He is. He's a really big guy.
And I like the way that you use the opportunity in dialogue with characters. Well, a lot of characters change their mind because they're presented with certain facts, and they change the side they were on.
Yeah, just like us. You know,
exactly.
We learn, we grow, and our perceptions of change, and everything changes all the time, and everything evolves, and hopefully we do too. Otherwise, you know, life gets boring.
Exactly. Well, it's not boring for Alex and Sid at all.
No. They have their hands full.
Yes, they're good characters.
Well, you know, it's very interesting for me as a writer is all I got, you know, and I'm not the first one to say this, but, you know, you get your characters and you have your novel, you have your story. Once I create the character, I don't have to make up what he's going to say. I mean, I just go to him, and then I just write down what he says.
Isn't that an amazing thing in writers, how if we get to know a character, we can actually hear him, and he speaks to us?
Oh, yeah.
I love it.
That goes on constantly in my head. And you just sit there, and you're just the secretary. You're just writing it.
Right. Just transcribe it.
Yeah. And so that's the real fun, creative part of writing. Of course, is the initial conceptualization and even the initial editing and mm-hmm. you know, fleshing out what isn't, cutting back what is. But you know, and any writer who's listening or knows this, it's also just 90% hard work.
It's true,
and what makes it work is anything that you have a passion for, anything you love, it doesn't work. So you know, that's the thing in life, is to find that one thing, and you got the passion for it. Doesn't matter what it is.
That's right.
It could be pottery. My wife's got the farmer gene. I mean, our place is a secret garden. It's just amazing.
Oh.
This is quite a showcase. My point is, as an artist, in the Four Corners area, you guys have wall-to-wall artists. It's a fantastic area. I could easily live there. And, as a matter of fact, we did for a couple of years in Santa Fe. But, you know, any artist knows is you just, there. The faster you, according to Einstein, the faster you go in time, the more time slows down.
Right.
But I say that, you know, that an artist lives at the speed of light, because there is no time.
That's true.
You know, there is no time. You know, I work 4 or 5 hours a day, and I go, geez, today's over. How did that happen?
Right.
I don't even remember.
Right. Well, I want to talk more about your writing process, but first I think we should take a minute and let you read something from The Canistar Factor.
A story starts in the middle of things, right?
Yeah, exactly.
In medias res. So let's just start at the beginning, and I'll just read a few pages.
Sounds
that's
perfect.
Okay.
You bet.
All right. So, chapter one, A Winter's Tale. Like any date with destiny, this one was blind. The letter was an invitation, if you could call it that, from a friend he had not heard from in almost 20 years. Mainly it was a list of reasons why he shouldn't come, which made it all the more compelling. The timing couldn't have been better. Alex Farmer had lost his way and desperately needed to get his life back. The commuter jet was less than a mile out when the airfield finally appeared through the overcast. The plane screamed out of the sky and touched down on the frozen runway. A December wind moaned softly, and blowing snow swirled across the tarmac as the passengers deplaned. It was one of those winter days in Montana when even the cows can't stand it. Alex headed for the terminal with the other passengers, clutching his jacket to his throat. He was a tall, slender man with thinning, sandy hair, who for the past year had walked slightly bent and with a small limp from the pain in his back, a pain that had returned with a vengeance now that he was off the prescription drugs. Sleepless nights had taken their toll on his handsome features and given him a haunted, haggard look. 38 years old, he looked less like a young doctor now and more like a sailor too long at sea. The hospital director in Los Angeles had given him a choice. He could resign his position in the ER or lose his license. That's what sent him into rehab. He was clean and sober for the first time since the accident. He didn't know how long it would last. Alex stood looking for his ride, shivering at the airport curb with his only luggage, a black backpack, slung over his shoulder. All he saw was the snow that blew across the icy asphalt. He didn't think it was possible to lose the feeling in his fingers this fast. Then out of the colorless day came the grinding sound of an ancient engine and a wreck of an old truck pulled up under the airport canopy. The driver reached across and pushed open the passenger door that creaked on rusted hinges. Alex Farmer? He nodded, too cold to speak. Whatever his old friend might look like now, this wasn't him. In fact, as near as Alex could tell, it wasn't a him at all. It was a her who was muffled under so many layers of scarves, sweaters, and long johns that the only thing visible under her hat was a glossy mane of raven-black hair that fell long and dark around her shoulders, the shoulders of a coat that was almost as worn out as the truck. He hesitated, his breath coming in small clouds, and for a moment was captivated by the lush mystery of light like sun on ice that reflected off her shining hair. From within the shapeless mound of clothing, the muffled voice spoke again. It's not any warmer in here than it is out there. Probably better if you changed your mind anyway. She leaned back across to close the door. Alex caught the handle and with a grunt of irritation swung himself and his pack inside. I must be out of my mind. No argument there. I see he sent the limo. She looked at him sharply and saw in her pale blue eyes that she had been crying. Sorry. Her unabashed sadness had somehow touched him deeply. She saw him looking at her, and her eyes lost all expression. So where is he? Alex went on quickly. Maury Bernstein, I mean. She motioned with her head to indicate the bed in the back of the truck. I had to bring him into town anyway. He followed her gaze, rubbed the fog from the rear end with his sleeve, then rubbed frantically again and stared. In the bed of the truck was a body wrapped in a dirty tarp and hastily tied with ropes. What is this? His words stuck in his throat. Who is that back there? Her reply was lost in a terrible grinding of gears as the truck lurched forward. Smoke belched from the exhaust pipe and was quickly lost in the flat light as the truck followed the empty road out of the airport. Badly shaken, Alex asked how his friend had died. Hunting accident. Her voice was flat, almost a monotone. I'm not the one that found him. Maury doesn't hunt. He hated guns. I didn't say he was the one hunting. There was a pause each time she spoke, as if she were waiting for distant voices to tell her what to say next. What about the police? Police? Are you saying you haven't called them? This is Montana. What the hell is that supposed to mean? She was concentrating intently on the icy road and didn't answer. How do you know Maury? I worked for him at the university when I was there. The truck lost traction, started to slide, and she deftly corrected the slide. Also, I'm his landlord. Now stop bothering me so I can drive. 10 minutes later, the beat-up truck with the bound roll of canvas in the back containing the body of Maury Bernstein pulled into a driveway and stopped. The sign in the front yard, half buried in snow, read Appleseed Funeral Home. Alex stared. The mortuary was a huge, gracious, somewhat dilapidated, three-story brick Victorian house with a wraparound front porch, a witch's hat turret, and blacked-out windows on the third floor. It was painted a hideous red color with green and black trim, a color palette that made it look like a mansion haunted by colorblind ghosts. Attached to one side of the house, in front of where they were parked, was a modern structure that didn't go with the rest of the house at all, a flat-roofed, garage-type building that Alex assumed was where they kept the bodies and parked the hearse. The girl beeped the truck horn, the garage door opened, and she abruptly opened the driver's door and got out. A robust and extremely overweight undertaker stepped out into the cold wearing a short-sleeved shirt that fits snugly around his gigantic biceps. His professionally somber mask gave way to something far sadder as he came forward to hug the girl. With all the clothes she was wearing, he was unable to get his big arms all the way around her. Alex cautiously pushed open the creaking truck door on his side and stepped down. As he did, the faint smell of marijuana and the fresh air made him gag. He wrinkled his nose. The smell was mixed with something else he couldn't identify, a sweeter odor, almost like chocolate. The undertaker, struggling with his emotions, hugged the girl again before self-consciously breaking away. I couldn't believe it when you called. I still can't. No tears, Otis. If this ever happened, we said no tears, remember? She took his hand, squeezing it tightly. You loved him too, he whispered. I know you did. When the girl made no reply, Alex broke in. I'm going to need to examine the body.
I like the way you gave us a dead body right off the bat.
Yeah, it's really important to begin a story well. I mean,
right.
I love D.H. Lawrence, but, you know, you can't spend pages describing the flowers.
Right. But you actually do good descriptions on setting, worked in with a lot of action. So that works well.
Yeah, I seem to. People tell me I do environmental descriptions well, but I'm always editing myself not to over describe.
Right, it's that balance, isn't it?
Yes, it definitely is. Because, I mean, what you have to trust and believe in is the reader's imagination. The reader's got to,
right.
You know, that's, if they didn't have imagination, they wouldn't be reading in the first place.
Exactly.
You know,
it's so true.
So you got to trust them and just give them the suggestion,
right.
And then they're off and running.
So you do write full-time now?
Yes, and I have for 10 years.
And do you have other series or books out?
I wrote a second one immediately after this one, a dystopian thriller called 2076. That, too, needs to be rewritten, so I've taken it off the market. And it could easily be turned into a series, but that's down the line. I then wrote a third book that I spent almost a year on it, and it was huge, and it just was all over the place, and
mm-hmm.
it didn't come together. But there's so many good elements in it that I can cannibalize. I then wrote my classic piece of literature. It's 140,000 words. It's called Passengers in Time.
Wow.
It's a fictionalized biography, a semi-true memoir. And I really found the real thing I'm really interested in.
Ah.
And that is past lives. And it's how our past lives inform our present lives.
Mm-hmm.
And how we didn't learn then, we got to learn now, and how the people from then show up to, you know, if they wanted to do us in then, they wanted to do us in now. And,
right,
and, you
right.
know, the enemies from then and now. So to integrate that into a story. So that's what it is. And when I, with the first draft, there's got to be an overreaching story arc. In other words, you know, you got to involve the people who, at the beginning, it's going to be at the end, and then you plug all the other stuff in, and then the flashbacks all make sense, and you care. You can't start with a story, end the story, and then start the other story. You know what I mean?
Right, yes.
So, you know, these, again, the things that the writer learns along the way.
That's right.
So that it's a great, and it's a classic piece of literature. It will be the one I'll hopefully be remembered for, but it's in my drawer.
I understand.
Nobody has seen it.
I get that.
I just signed another six-book suspense thriller mystery series with Speaking Volumes.
Oh.
That's set in the Bahamas, a couple of Bahamian treasure hunters.
Oh, wow.
And that one, it's called Treasure Islands plural, and the treasure of Abaco Island, the treasure of Eleuther Island, the treasure of Grand Bahama Island, et cetera, the six books. And each one, treasure hunters, Sam Serini and Nikki Perez, they bring up a treasure, and that triggers past life memories and connections.
Mm.
And in trying to return it to the rightful owner, you know, then we get back involved with, because I love telling historical drama, so
right,
I can tell
right.
the historical drama and yeah. connect that to the present day drama and the present day people. So
yeah.
that's the premise of all six books in that series.
Oh.
So that'll be the next series.
And when will the Organ Grinder Factor be out?
The Organ Grinder Factor, this is just a guess, but I think September.
And let's see, you have a website at stephensteelbooks.com.
Yeah, it's a new website. Everybody tells me it's really
yeah, it is a great much. It's a great website.
I sure appreciate you having me on. It's been a lot of fun, and I enjoyed
yes.
talking to you, Tracy.
Thank you. And that was Stephen Steele talking about his book, The Canistar Factor, number one in the Trouble with Miracles trilogy. This is Tracy Hales-Vass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.